Some peasants, carrying plows, followed us on the way to their work, others were already occupied in distributing water in the irrigation canals. Although it was November, the temperature was mild. A winter crop grows in these valleys, so different in every respect from the bleak and icy Trans-Himalayan Tibet. Here is a country where life is pleasant and easy, and nothing would interfere with the joviality of its inhabitants, if the taxes levied by the authorities did not increase every year. We chatted with several people on our way till we reached the forest. Going through it, we ascended a pass called Tundola, the height of which is approximately 11,200 feet. Here, for the first time since leaving Yunnan, we pitched our tent. We had climbed down from the pass without finding any water on the road. At last I discovered a small spring in a narrow ravine and decided to stop there. It was extremely damp. I feared that we would both get sore eyes if we slept unsheltered, and thought that the tent might also afford us protection against wild animals who might carry off a part of our food supply during the night. However, we pitched it only long after nightfall and took it down before daybreak. In the morning, we saw for the first time the River New, which flowed swiftly in a deep gorge to join the Jiamo New Chu. We crossed it on a good bridge. At that time a large party of pilgrims overtook us and begged my companion to tell their fortunes. It is regarded as an unpardonable sin for a lama to refuse such a request. A Red Hat sect lamas, in particular, who are credited with a profound knowledge of occult lore, can only with difficulty avoid acting as fortune tellers, astrologers, exorcists, and the like. My companion endeavored to combine each of his consultations with some simple words about the true Buddhist doctrine which might lead his hearers away from their deep-rooted superstition. He also added, according to circumstances, some advice about cleanliness, as far as hygiene can be understood by Tibetans. On this occasion I had to remain for more than half an hour seated beneath a scorching sun which struck the yellowish barren cliff behind me. Yongden could not get rid of the exacting devotees. One consulted him about the way his cattle were prospering during his absence, another, desirous of adding a few carved stones in remembrance of his pilgrimage to the Mendong which stood in his village, wished to know what would be the most meritorious and lucky sentence to inscribe on them. An overtired girl suffered from sore feet and feared to be left behind. She anxiously wanted to know if she would be able to walk in a few days' time, and her mother insisted upon knowing the name of the demon who had caused the swelling of the girl's feet and had stiffened her legs. That it could be the natural effect of long tramps neither she nor her daughter nor their companions would ever have admitted. Faithful to a method which, for some years, had allowed us to relieve and cure many suffering Tibetans, Yongden, with impressive gravity, counted the beads of his rosary, threw some pebbles in the air, caught them again in his hand before they touched the ground, and performed a few other ceremonies, 49, accompanied by an unintelligible muttering in broken Sanskrit. My adopted son is really gifted for such ritualistic work and, had he continued his life in a lamasery, he might have become quite famous as an oracle or exorcist. But he had preferred an orthodox form of Buddhism which prohibits all superstitions. I see, he said, after some time, there is a way to get rid of that demon, who is of a wicked kind. Listen well, all of you, so as to remember what I am about to tell you. The pilgrims immediately surrounded the lama, some squatting at his feet, some standing motionless with their backs against the cliff, straining their minds in a mighty effort to understand what the nonchisa would order, a picturesque group, of which I felt sorry not to be able to take a snapshot. You will find a Khotan on your way, declared Yongden, a prophecy that could not but be fulfilled, for Khotan are numerous in Tibet. You will stop at that place, and the sick girl will lie down next the Khotan for 3 days, well sheltered, so that the sun's rays do not touch her head. Thrice each day, at sunrise, noon, and sunset, you will all assemble and chant Dolma. Those who do not know Dolma, will recite Manx. The girl will go round the Khotan 3 times while you are chanting, and, save for that short walk, she shall not move during the 3 days. After having walked round the courton, the girl shall be each time well fed. Her feet and legs shall then be massaged in hot water, wherein you will put a pinch of the holy sand of the most sacred same monastery, which I will give you. After this has been done, the earth that has been wetted by the water shall be removed, thrown far away in a hole, and carefully covered with stones or earth, for the power of the demon will be washed away with that holy water and fall on the ground next the courton. Should the demon fail to depart, this will show that you have made some mistake in performing the rite, and you must do it again at the second courton you see on your way. Now, listen again. None of you must leave his companions until you have all reached your country together, for I see that the demon would immediately follow those while apart from the girl, since he was not allowed to have his way with her, and would torment them in her stead. I will teach her mother Azunga, and it will be a protection for her daughter and all of you, as long as you remain together. The poor fellows felt as if in heaven. The Lama had spoken long, and what he had said they could neither well understand nor remember, which meant that he was exceedingly learned. Then Yongden commanded them to go on their way, and kept only the old mother, to impart to her the secret spell. Trembling, yet overjoyed at the thought that she had now nothing to fear from the evil spirits, the old woman bowed down with the utmost gratitude and went up the path, trying sotto voce to imitate the intonation of her initiator. "Ba, ba, ba," she muttered, and soon it turned into E, and finally seemed to stabilize itself in a sort of bleating, "Beela, beela." I pretended to tie my garters, which had become loose, so as to remain behind and laugh at leisure, my head hidden in my large thick sleeves. "What does it matter?" said Yongden, smiling. "The girl will get 3 days' rest, a little massage, and good food. And as the mother has the precious Zung and will not leave her daughter, the other people will not abandon her, either. That is good honest work, and, moreover, I learned such tricks from you." I could not reply. He was right, and I, too, thought that we had done a kind service to the afflicted and suffering maid. When we reached the top of the cliff, we saw fields in all directions and a village before us, which we subsequently learned was called K. Most of the Neskoppers had already reached it, and some were running back toward us. "Oh, Lama," they said, "what a learned nonchalant you are. You told us rightly that we would quickly see a courton. There it is, and the girl is already lying down. Please accept tea from us." A courton was indeed there, and also a small monastery whose few inmates, before long, heard about their wonderful colleague. The pilgrims, who were not beggars, but villagers of some means, had already bought several pots of spirit and drunk them, and they were now telling about strange miracles performed by my innocent companion. Each had contemplated a greater wonder than his friends. One asserted that, when crossing the river New, he had clearly perceived that the Lama had not walked on the bridge, but alongside it, in Madeira. Although he had not drunk any spirit, being a strict teetotaler, Yongden felt somewhat infected by their excitement. He told stories of far-off countries where he had been on pilgrimages. I began to think that the fun was going too far. The whole village and the local trippers had congregated round him, and he went oil-making, telling fortunes and the like. People brought presents, which he graciously accepted. I did not like such a compromising fame, but perhaps I was wrong, for who could have supposed that the mother of such a brilliant sorcerer was a foreign lady? I managed, nevertheless, to attract the attention of my son, and with perhaps somewhat stern fervor I ejaculated, "Karma." Perhaps a trifle vexed at having up his triumph, Yongden declared that he would now ask leave to go on his way. People exclaimed that it was not possible, for the next village was far, we could not reach it before night, and not a drop of water was to be found on the way. Better, they added, it was to spend the night amongst them, they would give us a good room. My companion felt tempted, I understood it, but to the shy imploring glance he cast in my direction I replied with a still more fervid "Karma Parkinno," which moved some of the people around me, who repeated devoutly, "Karma Parkinno. Karma Parkinno." Thus we went, and happy I felt to find myself again in silence and solitude. I scolded Yongdan for the way in which he made himself conspicuous and told him a lot of things which made him sulky. We climbed a pass which was about 7,500 feet high, and from the descended a dusty path cut into a range of white hills that reminded me of Kansu in northern China. Of water, truly, there was none, and the prospect of getting nothing to drink, either that evening or the next morning, added to the bad humor of the lama. The new moon lighted our way, and if we had not been tired we could easily have walked a part of the night. But at the sight of a small cave perched high above the road the desire to sleep overpowered us and we yielded to it all the more easily, since we had left behind two passes and a river, the dreaded Thana, and feared nothing from the next village. How wrong we were! Picturesque indeed was our hostelry, with a small platform in front, but rock and terrad were both so diminutive in size that we were fearful of rolling out of them in our sleep, and breaking our necks on the rocks below. The morrow whopped to be the first of a series of eventful days, well qualified to prostrate with nervous breakdown one less strong than myself. We arrived at the village, which is called Wabo, in the middle of the morning, hungry and more especially thirsty. This was quite natural, as we had taken no refreshment whatsoever in our midday stay with the pilgrims near the Khotan. We had laughed so much at the demons the day before, that maybe a little one amongst them wished to play us a trick and suggested to us the idea, which we ought never to have conceived, of stopping to make tea near a place where water had been brought through a rustic wooden aqueduct for the villagers. A little snow had fallen during the night. I collected what twigs and dry cow dung I could find around the spot, while Yongdan began to light the fire. The water was very long in boiling, my companion very slow in eating and drinking, and, as a result, a number of villagers, a first two or three, then a dozen, and finally perhaps twice that number, gathered round us. A good woman, seeing how little wood I was able to pick up on the road, brought me some from her house. All would have gone smoothly had Yongdan only spoken the tenth part of the winged words by means of which, like the divine Ulysses, he had delighted and bewitched the natives of Khon the previous day, but an image could not have been more silent than the orator of yesterday. He did not utter a word or make a gesture. He only ate and drank and ate alternately and endlessly. People looked at us with deep astonishment. Tibetans are a talkative lot, and Yongdan's attitude upset all their notions concerning Ajapas. "Who are these people?" asked a woman, doubtless in the hope that we would answer the question. But the lama preserved the same stern silence. What a pity! In my carefully devised secret code of formute for all emergencies I had not provided for the order, talk. And now I was powerless, drinking my tea humbly behind the lama, who was seated on an old sack I had spread, 54, for him. I thought it prudent to accentuate my respect and to serve Yongdan in all ways to avoid any suspicion about my personality. Alas! That, too, nearly turned to my loss. I half taken away the empty kettle, at present used as a teapot, and proceeded to wash it. But the contact of the water with my hands had the natural result of cleaning them, and with that beginning of cleanliness appeared the whiteness of my skin. I had not noticed this, so distressed was I by the strange danger fraught behavior of Yongdan, when a woman, in a low voice, said to another near her, had she ever seen foreigners? That was doubtful, unless she had been at Bartang, or elsewhere in Chinese Tibet, or again in Giants, in the extreme south of the country. But every Tibetan is imbued with a strong conviction about the cast of the foreigner's features. He or she is tall, fair-haired, with white skin, rosy cheeks, and white eyes, which may be understood to be the color of any iris that is not black or dark brown. So the color of my skin betrayed me nationality. I did not show in any way that I had heard the remark, and quickly rubbed my hands on the bottom of the greasy, smoked kitchen utensil. Amongst the villagers there were now three soldiers. Good heavens, there was a post in that village, and very likely there was none in Thana, which we had passed with such precautions. What would become of us? I feared a rumor spreading, Are they pu-ings? And that petrified llama still continued to masticate some tsampo. I did not dare even to pronounce the Karma Pakeno translated by "let us be quickly off," lest my voice, in that awkward silence, should attract more attention to me. At last Yongden rose and Lilija ventured to ask him where he was going. What a terror, it was here, before all these prying eyes, that we were to leave the Pilgrim's Road, since we were exactly at the junction of the road entering the New Chu Valley and of the one going to China by way of the Kaha Kapo Range. That is, we had to confess openly that we intended to proceed toward the center of Tibet. Yongden calmly told them that we had made the pilgrimage, circumambulating the Kakapo, that it was now over, and that we were going back to our own country. He did not add anything more. He put his load on his back. I imitated him, and we started off among the people, on the very road they all take when going to Lhasa. And then the miracle happened. The little mischievous spirit who had enjoyed himself at our expense gave up the joke and began another one to our advantage. The strain that was felt by everyone relaxed. El heard some men saying, jestingly, "Pilgrims going on a pilgrimage." This idea seemed extremely funny, and they all laughed. We climbed toward a pass known as the Tongla. Traveling in Tibet is a continual going up and down. A single day's march leads one through considerable differences of level. This peculiarity adds greatly to the fatigue of the pedestrian, especially when he carries, as we did, a load on his back. But it also greatly enhances the charm of walking because of the great diversity of scenery which one sees each day. After having crossed the ridge, we found a good straight path through the forest which led to a valley in which, to my great astonishment, I saw a river flowing toward China. At that time I had not yet read the accounts of the few explorers who, years ago, had trodden that same path when this part of Tibet had not yet been taken away from its old rulers and when, as I have already mentioned, foreigners were allowed to visit it. Like me, they had all been puzzled by the mysterious river which seems to run toward the Mekong, whereas it is known that a gigantic range, crowned with everlasting snow, separates its watershed from that of the Salween. But as my information told me of but a single river, namely the New Chu, which I was to follow upstream, I concluded that it took a bend round the range I had just crossed. A man whom I met down in the valley confirmed the fact. The river I had crossed 2 days before, which was then flowing toward the Salween, was the very same that I now saw before me. The man explained to us that we should cross a bridge nearby and proceed upward to the monastery of Pido, where we could purchase food. He also told us that the road following the stream led to Itans, in Chinese territory, across several passes. The country looked pretty. It was well cultivated and the upper part of the hills was woody and green, although it was winter. A little farther from the bridge, a rounded spur divided the valley into two parts. The river flowed to the right, and a wide slope on which several villages were perched occupied the left. Behind the villages was a path leading to the mountains. For a little while, I felt tempted to take that road, thinking that it was a short cut to the Salween side. But reflection convinced me that I was still too near Chinese territory to attract attention by following a route of my own. Prudence demanded that I should continue for a time along the path trodden by Arjapaza where we would pass unnoticed. Exploration, and its joys, would come later. The sun set after we had crossed the bridge. I meant to pass the monastery at night, and to hide myself early in the morning at some distance from it, leaving to Yongden the task of going alone to purchase some food. I would gladly have camped near the river where there was a charming natural grove with rivulets of clear water. But the lamasery was still far away, and it was better for the success of my scheme to stop only when we were close to it. For the first time we made use of one of the rubber bottles we had carried with us, which were ordinary hot water bottles. When I decided to add two of them to our extremely reduced luggage, I thought that they might help travelers devoid of blankets, as we were, to bear the cold of the winter nights in high altitudes. They could also be used to carry water across the dry regions. Yet, on account of their foreign aspect, we dared not fill them before Tibetans, and for that reason we suffered thirst more than once when we could have easily carried with us enough water to make our tea. We had, however, disguised our bottles in a style akin to that of their owners, covered with a case of thicknambure plain red for one, and red and yellow for the other. They had become chapelooks, that is to say, water pouches worn by lamas of yore, whose sham patterns continue to form part of the ecclesiastic garb of present-day lamaist monks. Though clothed in that fashion, there was considerable difference between our bottles, which came directly from a big American firm, and the purely conventional and useless simulacra that hang on the lama's shamthabs. However, as we did not mean to exhibit them freely, from a distance they could create a sufficient illusion. Moreover, any article of our outfit which attracted the attention of the natives was immediately represented to them as having been purchased at Lhasa, and this gave us an opportunity of relating the wonders of the great city where so many foreign goods are offered for sale. People listened to Yongnan, or to myself, if the audience happens to be mostly women. We cleverly spoke of other objects much more wonderful, that easily made them forget those found in our bags, and these were prudently hidden again. Before the beginning of our journey I had settled with the Lama that in any story we might invent, according to circumstances, we should never appear as people coming from outside Tibet, but that, on the contrary, those whom we should meet should be made to believe that we had travelled from Lhasa to the border, and were now on our way home. This gave us a certificate of Tibetan nationality and did away with the curiosity and the suspicion which fastens upon newcomers in the country. This was much safer in every way and allowed us also to speak as having bought at Lhasa the few foreign articles we carried with us. We filled one of our bottles at the stream and left the pretty grove behind. The Gompa Monastery was situated a good distance from the bridge and night came before we had even discovered it. We followed a path cut in a woody slope above the river New. As it curved, we saw several fires burning higher up, which reminded us of those which had frightened us the second night after our departure. Most likely travelers camped there whom we should meet if we proceeded, which prospect displeased us greatly, yet to wait until they had started next morning would have upset our scheme and forced us to pass the Gompa in the middle of the morning, which we disliked even more. An official was established there, we had been told, and in any case I did not wish in the least to meet the troopers of the place. The monks were much more to be feared by us than ordinary villagers, for whereas the latter seldom leave their homes and know but little of the world beyond them, the enterprising clerical fellows travel all over Tibet in China, India, Mongolia, and even in faraway Siberia. They see a lot of things and a lot of men, pilgrims included, and are as a rule much more alert than their lay countrymen. We walked again for a while and reached the border of the woods. The ground had been cleared for cultivation, and our path, which had become very narrow, kept skirting the fences that enclosed the fields. On our left side, its edge ended abruptly above the river bank. The fires had ceased to flare and were luckily far from the road. We proceeded quickly and in the utmost silence. The new moon had set. We vaguely discerned some black form which might have been the walls of the monastery, and deemed it wise to wait until dawn, lest we should mistake our way here the lamasery, where several village paths probably crossed one another, and where dogs would bark if we wandered about. A cold wind swept the cliff, no shelter was at hand. The best place we discovered was next a stone which screened us a little. I had carried the rubber bottle under my dress to prevent the water from freezing on the way, still, it was far from being even tepid when we drank a draught of it with a handful of dried sampa for our supper. Then I lay down on the ground, keeping in my arm, as well covered as a child, the bottle containing the remainder of the water to drink when we should awake. Small heads of rocks piercing through the earth made a really painful couch, even for me, who from youth upwards had been accustomed to the bare boards affected by the Greek Stoics. When we got up, at the first rays of dawn, we saw the monastery standing a few steps before us and not at all in the direction we had thought it to be when arriving at night. We passed along the walls and made haste to be out of sight. A well-dressed native chief passed us on horseback, coming from the road that leads toward Bartang. He threw us an indifferent glance without stopping. We could now see that there was no suitable place near the Gompa where I could wait safely while Yongdan made his purchases. Our way descended a narrow valley in which flowed a small tributary of the River New. Several farms and mills had been built on its banks. We met also an important trader's caravan coming from Lhasa. People were to be seen everywhere. I thought for a while that I could stay higher up in the woods, but already a girl was driving cattle in that direction. We continued to walk, exceedingly annoyed at moving away from the Gompa, for we urgently needed fresh supplies of food. Healthy pedestrians like us have good appetites, and, at the risk of appearing a character devoid of all poetry, I confess that I ate a large quantity of barley meal butter and bread, when fortunate enough to get wheat flour to make it. And in that respect the Lama was very like Lhasa's adopted mother. After crossing the small valley, I discovered some large fields which were not to be cultivated before spring. I remained here a few hours, seated behind bushes, reading a Tibetan philosophical treatise, until Yongdan, who had gone back to the Gompa, returned, loaded like a mule. We then enjoyed an exceptional meal, a broth thickened with wheat flour. Filling our breast pockets with dried apricots, we started off cheerfully. In the afternoon we again entered a wild region. We met some pilgrims walking leisurely, who belonged to a large party, numbering at least 50 people, whose vanguards we found farther along, already camped, boiling tea in cauldrons the size of tubs. Yongdan was delayed a long time. Some asked him to tell their fortunes, others to foresee happenings of importance for them or their families. Many came forward to be blessed. Seated on the ground, I watched with amusement the various performances in which Lama and believers play their parts with the utmost gravity, tinged, however, by that special good humor and overflowing gaiety which makes life among Tibetans so pleasant. I delightedly forgot Western lands, that I belonged to them, and that they would probably take me again in the clutches of their sorrowful civilization. I felt myself a simple doctor of the Kokonor. I chatted with the Voman about my imaginary black tent in the desert of grass, my cattle, and the feast days when the menfolk race on horseback and show their cleverness as marksmen. I knew by heart the region I described, for I had lived along, and my enthusiasm for my soft-tailed mother country was so genuinely sincere that no one could have guessed my lie. After all, was it entirely a lie? I am one of the Genghis Khan race who, by mistake and perhaps for her sins, was born in the Occident. So I was once told by a Lama. At sunset we again found the dark forest with huge trees. The traok was good, and as we had wasted so much time with the pilgrims, we wished to continue walking as long as possible. Going down toward a ravine in which flowed a small stream, I noticed something lying on the ground, and on nearing it, I saw that the object was an old fur-lined bonnet, such as is worn by the women of Kham. Yongdan lifted it with the iron end of his pilgrim's staff and threw it off the road. The bonnet did not go far, nor did it fall on the ground. It flew rather like a bird, and alighted, if I may use that word, on the broken trunk of an enormous tree. A strange intuition warned me that the ugly-looking, dirty article was to be of great use to me, and that, indeed, it had been sent to me, and in obedience to this occult suggestion I went down the track to fetch it. Yongdan did not like to carry it. Tibetans, when on a journey, never pick up even their own hats if they happen to fall from their heads to the ground, and would think still less of taking anyone else's they found on the road. They think that it would bring them bad luck. On the contrary, to find a boot on the road is a good omen, and often travelers lift it, worn out and dirty as it may be, and place it for 1 second on their heads. My companion was free from such superstitions, but the greasy fur disgusted him and he could see nothing wonderful in such a find. A pilgrim, he said, had put it on the top of the load he carried on his back, and the bonnet had fallen off without its owner being aware of it. Either that, or the pilgrim, on account of the prevalent superstition, had preferred to abandon it. I do not go so far, I replied, as to believe that some millionaire goddess has sown it for me seated on a lotus in paradise. No doubt, a mere human being has lost it. But why has he or she lost it just there? Well, rejoin my young companion, jokingly, let us think, then, that an invisible friend of yours has pulled it off in order that it may fall on your way to a most precious gift, indeed.